will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself?
On today's show.
One thing that we found was when you remind people that they don't have enough of something, people actually process information at a higher, more abstract level. So they kind of view the world from that, you know, 30,000 feet. And it's because when you think about things more abstractly, you are more likely to identify creative routes to overcoming obstacles.
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, a podcast where we discuss strategies and advice for how to climb the S-curve of learning in your professional and your personal life, disrupting who you are to slingshot into who you want to be. I'm your host, Whitney Johnson, and today our guest is Kelly Goldsmith. Kelly received her PhD from Yale, is now a professor at Vanderbilt, where she's received numerous teaching awards, including being one of the youngest professors ever to be nominated for Professor of the Year at Kellogg, where she taught previously. Kelly studies how people respond to uncertainty and scarcity, uncovering the seemingly paradoxical effects, which is why I wanted you to hear from her. Pursuing a disruptive course involves embracing constraints, the lack of something, which in addition to her academic research, Kelly knows about firsthand, not only because she went on the job market in 2008, but because she was a contestant on Survivor Africa, the third season of Survivor. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me, Whitney. It's a real honor.
So where did you grow up and what did you want to be when you grew up?
That is funny. No one ever asked me that. I'm from San Diego, California. That part I talk about a lot. I'm a proud Californian and Southern California, no less. What I wanted to be when I grew up, honestly, just like a lot of kids, it fluctuated a little bit. But I remember early on, I was a big TV watcher, big fan of television. And there was a show called Who's the Boss, which featured this woman, Judith Light was the actress, and she played Angela. And she was an advertising executive. And I thought her life looked so glamorous. And I really wanted to be a busy advertising executive with great, huge 80s hair and the suits and the shoulder pads. And that was the dream for a while.
Oh, well, you kind of did become an advertising person.
I kind of did. A very roundabout way, like most of 99% of what I do is being a marketing professor here at Vanderbilt, as you mentioned. But every now and again, I get brought in on consulting projects. And sometimes I get brought in to consult on ads. And every time I get brought in to consult on an ad, I'm like, I'm living the dream. Today, I am Angela from Who's the Boss. And it's great.
How did you become interested in the topic of scarcity?
When I was a grad student at Yale, I got to Yale in 2004, having been on a reality show and then like worked in LA in various types of jobs. And most notably, I worked in reality TV casting towards the end, which was super fun, but is not the traditional track to academic, you know, achievement. So I got to Yale and I felt like I was completely fighting out of my weight class. Like I'd never taken an economics course and now I'm taking PhD level economics at Yale. My training was very different than anything I was doing in graduate school. And that was evident, right? Like I was just not naturally as good at everything. I wasn't as facile in the literature. I didn't know how to design experiments. I didn't know anything really when I started grad school. Which is terrible, right? And I was very afraid of getting kicked out. And partly to kind of, I'm like, okay, well, what am I going to bring to the table? How can I force these guys to keep me around?
Instead of letting herself get discouraged or focusing on the gaps in her training and background, Kelly went to work. She took a look at what skills and strengths she already possessed and doubled down. She made herself indispensable as a hard worker. Whenever a professor had research they needed help with, Kelly was there. By trying to keep herself in the good graces of her professors, she not only published research in several different fields, she found her area of interest.
What I was really interested in was, you know, to me, goal setting was fascinating, right? How do you get people to work harder? How can you inspire people to work harder? How can you inspire yourself to work harder? And there were just, I thought the effects in the literature were so cool and there was so much neat stuff coming out at the time that it felt like a really exciting space to be in. With respect to understanding goals and motivation, really at the individual level. So not, you know, from an organizational behavior standpoint, but just as a human being who's always looking to engage in better time management and lose weight and be a better person and be happy, but also have fun. Like all these conflicting goals we have as people, I was really interested in understanding how those conflicting goals kind of play out across our decision-making process. I think the longer I exist as an adult and the more life experiences I have, the more I've come to realize that goal conflict as we progress through our life course only gets worse, right? Not better. once you have kids, you have a constant state of goal conflict where it's like, should I be spending more quality time with my family or should I really be building up my career, right? So there's always that tension. And I think for a lot of us, you almost feel like you can never, there's just never enough hours in the day. You can never really feel like you're doing a great job at everything all at once.
I want to kind of keep light touching on this idea of scarcity. When I read your research and listened to your TED Talk, what it sounds like to me is this continuum. So let me tell you what I understand, and then you can tell us, does this make sense, and kind of riff on it. So there's the, you have nothing. What do people do? Then there's the moving along the continuum. You have nothing, but there is the promise of something. You can help other people. So what do people do? Then there's the, I've got something, not a lot, but I've got something. And I'm starting to worry that that might go away. And then there's the, on the other end of the continuum, I've got a lot of something and I worry it will go away. So is that correct? And then can you just talk us through it and give us some color and detail around that continuum?
Well, one thing I will say, and this could just be like, I want to be transparent about the people I study in my experiments. So I can't speak to, like, there's lots of different types of scarcity in this world. You know, there's people and like people that I work with that study rural farmers in India pre-harvest who can't feed themselves or their family. Like there's that type of scarcity, which is qualitatively different than most of what I study. So what I study is you bring undergraduates into the lab. And these are people who oftentimes don't feel like they have enough. They're taking studies for money, right? So they don't feel like they have enough. On the other hand, they're not chronically poor. They can keep the lights on. They have a roof over their head.
Okay.
So that's just to kind of contextualize. Yep. And some people have given me grief when I present and they say, well, you know, you should be studying the bigger problems of poverty. And I totally agree. That's like really significant, important research that needs to get done. But I also think in terms of what my interest has always been, which is basically helping people understand how to make it through their day in this very complicated world that we live in, where we have a lot of pressure coming at us from different angles. I like understanding, you know, the middle of the bell curve and here in the United States and what the kind of struggles most of us face most of the time. The continuum question, I think the way you've asked it is interesting because at least given the people that I study, I find a lot of responses to scarcity that I consider to be very adaptive. Like originally when I got interested in this literature, the bulk of what was out there at the time was this kind of almost like pejorative perspective that scarcity made people, you know, cognitively impaired, which is to say scarcity made you stupid. There was a kind of a negative perspective on what scarcity did to people. And that's a bummer because a lot of us experience scarcity. And like I said, in all my experience in the lab and running these experiments, it's very easy to make people feel like they don't have enough. And if it's true that at least all these negative maladaptive consequences, like we're all kind of in for it, right? So so I started really pursuing this. A lot of responses to scarcity, at least among the people I study, are actually pretty adaptive for achieving your goals and navigating your circumstances. That doesn't activate the same mechanisms as when you feel like there's hope. It's when you feel like there's hope that it really kicks off the series of behaviors that I spent most of the past 10 years studying. If there is no hope and you believe there's no hope, people are very adaptive and don't just stand there and bash their head into the wall forever. Like they'll focus on something else, right? They'll shift their attention, which is good, right? Like I think we've all been there. Like when you get dumped, right? And the dude is not a girl or guy is not coming back, right? We don't just sit there and cry forever. Like eventually you get over it. And the same is true with scarcity. I think if it's never coming back, if people are very adaptive at rolling with those punches, we allow disruption to take place. And that's an adaptive response to, I guess what you could call in a way scarcity, but really it's just, you know, a lack of access is what we would call it, which I think is qualitatively different than scarcity because a lack of access, you may be sad for a second, you experience loss, but you move on. Scarcity, which what I've studied with the population I described is really about when you have that hope. Right? So you feel like you don't have enough, but there's still the hope that you could get some more. Mm-hmm. And that kicks off a lot of interesting psychological consequences. So as you mentioned, you can get this scarcity reaction that people will pursue, which is very adaptive, right? So if you feel like you don't have enough money and then you do some, you know, some budgeting or you think about how you could get a little side hustle going on or, you know, you contact friends, like you think about restructuring your life a little bit so as to have more, you know, kind of net positive at the end of the day, like that's a very adaptive response to scarcity. But that's not always what we observe in populations. So when we wrote this review paper that I talk about in the TED Talk, you can get this very adaptive response to scarcity where people try to engage in scarcity reduction. So they're already working two jobs. They don't have enough time to add more. They've got so many, you know, kind of hands out to them with respect to needing money that they just don't feel like they can increase their bottom line, but they still acknowledge, right, that they don't have enough. those people might engage in, you know, more of a compensatory route where they're trying to deal with their feelings of scarcity in an indirect way, like they're trying to repair how they feel, but they can't repair it directly by getting more of this resource they don't have enough of, but they could do it indirectly. And that's where you pick up on some consequences that may superficially appear maladaptive. So you've got somebody who feels poor and they go out and buy expensive shoes to make themselves feel richer because they feel like they can't directly repair the problem. Well, now they've got less money, right? So that looks maladaptive, but if you take a big step back, what they're looking to do is they can't make themselves feel richer by getting more money. So they're looking to make themselves feel richer through an indirect route through this compensatory consumption. Scarcity also activates a goal, like getting more of the resource you don't have enough of. So there's mechanisms associated with that. There's kind of one awesome paper that we have looks at how scarcity affects just your like cognitive processing, which is a very hardcore Psych 101 thing to study. And one thing that we found was when you remind people that they don't have enough of something, people actually process information at a higher, more abstract level. So they kind of view the world from that, you know, 30,000 feet. And it's because when you think about things more abstractly, you are more likely to identify creative routes to overcoming obstacles.
Let's double click on that, because that goes absolutely to the work that we do around how you embrace your constraints. So you said something really interesting. You just said that when people don't have enough of something, there's lots of different ways that we can respond to that. We can go into the compensatory behavior. We can, but we can also start to think, go into problem-solving mode. Talk to us about that.
I studied this thing called control level theory earlier in my career. And basically, control level theory is the notion that we can either, as we go through the world, kind of look at the nitty-gritty details, or we can look at the bigger picture. And there's chronic individual differences, there's cultural differences. Some people love to look at the nitty-gritty details. Some people are trained culturally to look at the nitty-gritty details. Some people look at it more naturally, look at it more abstractly and kind of take in the bigger picture. And then as we go through life, we can see things kind of in terms of the big picture or in terms of the nitty-gritty. And both, neither one, I should say, is the better way to do it, right? There's times when looking at the big picture is really advantageous. There's times when looking at the nitty-gritty is really advantageous, and looking at the big picture just gets in the way. So the first study that we ran was, I was like, okay, well, if you get people thinking about scarcity, they're going to want to solve the problem. So they're going to view it in this nitty-gritty way. And there's lots of different ways you can measure people's level of control. So we were thinking, okay, well, if you come at the world, you're thinking about scarcity, you're going to want to solve the problem, you're going to have a nitty-gritty focus. And that's what we tested. And in the paper, it gets into all the ways we tested it using these classic validated measures of control level, whether or not you're thinking more abstractly or concretely. And the opposite of what I predicted showed up and was statistically significant, which, you know, is always informative when that happens. So it wasn't that when you activate thoughts about scarcity, people were thinking in the more nitty-gritty way. In fact, they were thinking more abstractly. And it took us a long time. Like I said, it took like 10 years for that paper to get published, because it took us a long time for us to wrap our brains around why that kept happening across all these different measurements of control level, that people who were thinking about scarcity would actually think more abstractly. And it wasn't until I turned to the literature on constraints, and there what we saw is that thinking abstractly is what you have to do if you want to navigate constraints, right? You have to take that higher level perspective in order to find the unique way around the problem. And then we're like, oh my gosh, this is what's been going on all along in our scarcity studies, because what is scarcity? It's a constraint to goal pursuit. You don't have the resources you need to get where you want to get. And in fact, activating those thoughts subsequently made people think from this higher level, more abstract perspective, because they want to be able to navigate those problems.
One of the interesting things about Kelly's research is her finding that the feeling of scarcity doesn't come from what you actually have or possess. It comes from how much you think you have. And since that feeling of scarcity comes from your thoughts, you can manipulate it. You can change what you think about or feel about what you have.
Your own personal level of resources, as this is something we've measured a million times in our studies, and you would think that it would influence our results, because we usually manipulate scarcity in the sense that one way or another, we get people thinking about not having enough or not. I have never found that your own personal level of resources moderates the influence of the scarcity manipulation, which is kind of scary in a way, because what that tells us is it doesn't really matter how much you have. It matters how much you feel like you have. And we can knock around how much people feel like they have very easily. And this is not my research so much, but research by Isha Sharma and her colleagues, which is really interesting stuff that looks at financial deprivation. So these are people that like have enough money for a computer, that keep the lights on, they have electricity. So what you find there is you can make people feel poor very easily. Like you can make rich people feel poor very easily. For example, open up your Instagram feed around spring break time if you're me. And see all my girlfriends that are taking these glamorous ski trips or going to, everybody went to Greece last year, going to Greece, doing these exotic vacations. And I mean, it makes me feel poor, right? And even though I have plenty of resources to make it through the day, the lights are on, everybody's fed, everything's good. But it, again, it's very easily via social comparisons to make even people with perfectly adequate, if not abundant resources, feel like they don't have enough. I talk about this in the TED Talk. I do think this is a negative downstream consequence of social media, is that it can activate this almost like chronic, low-level feelings of scarcity among anybody. Because, I mean, you can't keep up with the Joneses, because if you move up in your social class, for example, your Joneses change, right? The Joneses just keep getting fancier. There is nobody who feels like they have enough money.
So you're saying that when you start trying manipulating and putting people in a position where they feel like they don't have enough, you get the same results when you just talk about money. Like
about
it doesn't
money.
Even have to be enough money or not enough.
Correct.
Just money itself is a trigger.
Correct. Correct. And I mean, they had, their manipulations were subtle, like the screensaver where it was flying dollar bills versus flying birds or whatever. So just exposing people to images of money leads to the same consequences as if you were prompt them with thoughts about scarcity. And I've never done studies on this directly, but it's always been like something that's burning in the back of my brain is something I want to do.
Yeah.
Because I think what happens when you prime people with money, when you just get them thinking about money, it automatically makes you think you don't have enough. Like, I just think, again, like we don't have Bill Gates as a participant in our studies. It's possible, like a Warren Buffett, it's possible there's people out there that are perfectly content, but I don't think those people show up on my campus to take my studies for $5 for 15 minutes kind of thing. But I mean, I think for most of us, most of the time, just mentioning money automatically makes us think.
That's fascinating. So you raised an interesting point. And you know, before the interview, I was having a conversation with my 19-year-old about to start college daughter, and asked her, well, what would you ask, Kelly? Mm-hmm. And her question was, I thought, a great one. And so I want to ask, so what happens when you do get triggered, when you do get in that place of like, I don't have enough? And objectively, it's not true. Like anybody else looking would say, objectively, this is not true, but subjectively you are. And I know this isn't what you study per se, but I have to think you thought about it.
Yeah.
What do you do when a person gets triggered into this place of subjective scarcity?
My early research dealt a lot with this notion of priming and like, how can you turn off any prime, right? Like the John Barge and colleagues, they looked at this kind of non-conscious priming across lots of domains. So like weird stuff people in that camp found is, you know, if you have a picture of your mom on your desk and your mom believes you should be an academic achiever, you'll actually do better on math tests than if you have a picture of your mom on your desk and your mom believes you should be a homemaker, right? Like the things we expose ourselves to in our environment fundamentally change our performance and the way we behave. So, but what anything in the priming literature would tell you is for pretty much any prime, like sunlight is the best disinfectant. So if you understand that you can be triggered by things in your environment and you understand, and this requires us to be very present, which is hard. I mean, I'm fully guilty of not being present most of the time, right? So it requires us, as we flip through our social media feed, to be conscious of the fact that, like, you know, my girlfriend Jenny's most recent trip on a yacht in the Mediterranean, like I am feeling feelings of jealousy. I am feeling like I don't have enough. I am feeling like my family vacations are pretty lackluster now that they look at hers. And like oftentimes we're going through life so fast, we don't even realize that we are not present enough to be aware of our thoughts. If we are aware of our thoughts, it gets a lot easier to say, like, I know what I'm feeling. I know why I'm feeling it. And I know that realistically, I don't have to feel that way. And honestly, this is just one picture from her one vacation. If you saw the 30 other ones she didn't post, probably her kids screaming and the yacht broke, or, you know, maybe the yacht didn't break. I don't know. Maybe it was perfect vacation, but you get the idea, right?
Yeah.
Like we all know when you take a step back, we all know that nothing's ever what it looks like on social media. So I don't think the problem is that, I never believe that consumers are dumb. I think we're well aware that social media isn't what it looks like. On the other hand, we just go through life fast, right? And Danny Kahneman has this great book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. And when we go through life fast, a lot of what we're doing just to make sense of our universe and keep moving is we're processing at a very superficial level, right? We're only engaging in that deep cognitive thought when we're saving it for when we absolutely need to, when we need to go to the ER and make a decision about should our kid have a cast, or, you know, when we have a really important presentation at work. Like, we're reserving our cognitive resources, our kind of mental horsepower for these really important things. We are not, and probably judiciously, not using a lot of our deep cognitive processes on flipping through our, you know, Instagram be.
Yeah.
But that said, if we actually force ourselves to have the presence to think about the messaging we're exposing ourselves to and how it affects us, like, we can pretty much instantly turn it off because we're better than that, right? Like, we know that we have enough. And if we know we don't have enough, this is another good thing. Let's say we figure out we don't have enough. What we can do is engage in that direct kind of adaptive response where we then say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to click out on my Instagram feed. I'm going to go to my mint.com. I'm going to look through my spending for this month. I'm going to see what's, I'm going to stack rank it by what's the highest spend. I'm going to think about where I can cut, and I'm going to start to make some smarter choices. Because I think, like, once you really shine a light on what the real problem is, it becomes a lot harder to just go through life scrolling through your feed and kind of
feeling bad for yourself. Okay.
So, yeah, exactly.
All right. So one of the things that I'm wondering is, as a person, and I'm thinking about scarcity for us as individuals, and I know I'm asking you to talk a little bit out of your field. Although I have to say, I love this whole meta thing of, number one, you were on Survivor. Number two, when you started your PhD, you felt a sense mm-hmm. of scarcity. As a consequence, you're scrambling to prove that you should be there. You work on lots of different projects, and that gave you this breadth of understanding of the literature that I'm now, as we're talking, you're able to draw on, which I suspect has made your research and your teaching that much more robust.
Oh, you are so sweet.
So what's interesting to me, though, is that in that moment when you felt a sense of scarcity, mm-hmm. you used it as a zoom out. What do I need to do? You got very strategic.
Right.
You said, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to disrupt myself, to do something different, mm-hmm. to do something better. The question I have for you, Kelly, is when you've got a person who's on the launch point of an S-curve, are mm-hmm. there things that you can do? Because scarcity does different things for different people.
Right.
Have you done any research on how you can prime people to use scarcity in a productive way? And have you done any research on being able to determine who are the people that respond to scarcity well, and who are the people that don't respond to scarcity quite as well?
Right. This is a great question. So one thing I would say, and I deeply believe this, is one problem, like the kind of blessing and a curse of scarcity, it gives you a goal, but it also gives you a threat. For most of us, most of the time, the difference between a goal and a threat just is very, very, very subtle, right?
Huh.
So if you think about getting on the scale, for some people, I get on the scale, I weigh more than I want. That creates a goal. Okay, I need to lose weight. I'm going to set a plan. I'm going to get a good app. I'm going to track things, whatever. For other people, you get on the scale and you see a threat. It's like, oh gosh, I'm never going to get there. I'm so weak. I'm a bad person. I make all these negative self-attributions. And then what do you do to feel better about yourself? What's easiest? You eat, right? Mm-hmm. So the same thing, getting on the scale can be either a goal or a threat. Some literature and some research I did with my dad, I should say, looked at happiness and how to increase happiness and increase employee engagement. And interestingly, they are just the act of introspecting on if you are happy. Almost everybody realizes they're not as happy as they want to be. I guess that's the downside. For some people, it creates a goal. You know what? I'm not as happy. I could think I'd be happier. Mm-hmm. It creates a goal. They start thinking about things they could do differently in their life. They think about people they should reach out to. Very positive. Other people, it's a threat. I'm never going to be happy. I've never been happy. How can I put myself in this situation? Look at all the things I've done. I'm terrible, demotivating. They do things that make them feel worse about themselves. They reinforce the stereotype they place on themselves. Down the spiral they go, right? And so goals in general, happiness, and then also scarcity, right? When you, just like anything else, you realize you don't have enough money. You realize you don't have enough of, you know, some resource, time. It can be a motivating goal or it can be a debilitating threat. This is why I try really hard not to judge anybody based on how they respond to a goal or to scarcity, because I think the kind of needle that toggles between goal and threat is easily pushed around by a whole lot of things.
Fascinating.
Any given topic can tip between being a goal or a threat when you recognize you're not quite where you want to be. And that to me is the biggest predictor of if it's going to have a positive outcome or a negative outcome. And so the first thing I say when I'm advising people about how to respond to scarcity is, number one, you need to just accept, take a step back, be present, accept the fact that you're facing scarcity. Don't keep scrolling through the feed, right?
Uh-huh.
Maybe accept the fact that you're facing scarcity and then ask yourself, is this scarcity real? What's the evidence that I'm really experiencing scarcity? Is it just that my friend Jenny took an amazing vacation and it kind of activated more like jealousy or envy, but not really scarcity?
Yep.
Or in fact, am I looking at my bank balance and holy cow, I can't pay my nanny this month, right? That's more like scarcity, right? So I think, number one, accept the fact that this feeling I'm experiencing in this moment, in my day, it's actually driven by the fact that I feel like I don't have enough. So kind of be present in the moment and recognize how you feel. Then question yourself and say, is the scarcity real? And if it's not real, it's very easy to get over it. If you recognize, you know what, that's just subjective scarcity. I was triggered by this thing in my environment that I'm actually doing just fine. You could actually keep going just fine.
Yep.
But if it is real, then I would say this number two step is, so if you feel lonely, for example, that is a form of scarcity, what we call social scarcity. You don't have enough people interacting with you, but it's hard to quantify, like, how many friends do you need not to feel lonely? Or like, what, you know, how many conversations should I have with my spouse per day to not feel lonely? I don't know, right? I think that's very hard to quantify. So I don't have, right now, my research doesn't offer solutions to those problems, but we can give good solutions. If you go through your day, you're present, you recognize you're experiencing scarcity, you question yourself, is the scarcity real? The answer is yes. You want to try to quantify, like, how much do I have? How much do I need, right? Put a number on it. Because that goal, it's much better if you can quantify it, if you can measure it, if you can track it, kind of hold yourself accountable. Any problem, like I tell my students, you're just one good spreadsheet away from changing your life, which I think is true. Where do I want to be? Where am I now? Then recognize that disparity. And honestly, people get, this is like getting on the scale. For some people, it makes them very nervous about knowing, like recognizing the difference between where they are and where they want to be. But I mean, 99 times out of 100, recognizing that disparity is sort of liberating, right?
Yeah.
Because you knew it was there, right? You knew you weren't where you wanted to be. And now you've got a number on it. And almost like automatically by envisioning that gap, like understanding the size of that gap, you can start to come up with solutions, right? Because the solution you need if you need to lose 200 pounds is different from the solution you need if you need to lose 20 pounds or 5 pounds, et cetera. So acknowledging that gap is huge. And then the solutions honestly come naturally. People think that coming up with solutions is going to be the hardest part. And I always tell them that that is the easy part. That's the fun part, right? It's easy. You can ask your friends, go online. In this day and age where it's easier and faster to get access to information from smart people all over the world, all the time, coming up with solutions is not the problem, right? Just take an assessment of all the solutions that are out there. Pick your top five. Then the critical next step is you've got to hold yourself accountable. And you've got to track your progress. And that's where a lot of people fall short. If you can pull it off, you can solve almost any scarcity-related problem. You can achieve almost any goal. Like, we're all intrinsically capable of it. But the downside is, I promise, once you solve that problem, you're going to find a new one.
Yeah.
So, you know, which is like kind of exciting that we have this constant motivation to get better and better and be better and better people. And there is no good enough. So it's I try to, again, view it through a positive lens that we're all so intrinsically motivated. I guess the negative lens on it is we are a little bit like a hamster in a wheel as we go through life.
One of the things that I was thinking about when you were talking about this is this, you know, if you're a boss or a leader, you know, any suggestions you have for how do you create scarcity for the people that work for you? Because as you said earlier, if there's some scarcity, that actually motivates people to improve themselves.
Yeah.
But how do you do that without, and of course I'm going to say this, getting someone or having people feel like they're going to get voted off the island? So any thoughts on how do you strike that balance, or what have you seen has worked for you specifically?
Well, I mean, you could certainly talk to anybody in sales, right? There's a lot of people in jobs out there where they have to make numbers. What is that doing? That's creating a sense of scarcity. You're giving them a number. They are not at that number. Their bonus is contingent on their ability to make that number. And that is motivation by activating a sense of scarcity, right? So, or if you're at an organization where the top 10% of performers are going to get a bigger bonus or whatever the incentive is, what you're doing there is you're activating a sense of scarcity, right? It's a zero-sum game. Only the highest achievers are going to get this bonus, and that can be very motivating. So if you're at an organization where only the top 10% of performers are going to get the incentive or the bonus, and you realize early on that, like, you can't get there from here, right? You're never going to make it into the top 10%. You had a bad Q1 and there's just no way to recover. How do you keep that person motivated? And I think this is the open question, because really, in order, like I said before, this goes back to what you mentioned about the continuum. If I'm in the bottom 30% of performers and the distance, I just can't get to the top 10% by Q4. I just can't do it. There's no way. Even my best performance, I'm not going to get there. Why wouldn't I disengage, right? Why wouldn't I just give up? Because that's the adaptive thing to do. So in order to make those people motivated, what you really need to do is you need to give them this continual sense of hope, right? If there's no hope, why would anybody work hard on? They've got other things to do, right? They've got a million fish to fry.
So basically what you're saying is that if you're a manager, if you've got a person who's not necessarily going to get that top 10% bonus, you still have to find a way
something
for them to be motivated. Because like you said, if you know you're going to be voted off the island, then you know you are. So you just stop trying, period.
Why would you try? Yeah, you need to keep them engaged. And I think there's a lot of good ways of doing that. Even just like positive affirmations, letting them know you're still watching. Like, let them know that their performance still matters, even if they're not going to be able to hit that critical cutoff.
Right. If you think about this idea of introverts versus extroverts, and I wondered, so an introvert may have, well, not may, will have less energy to give to the outside world, which is in its own way a form of scarcity in terms of their attention that they have to give to others is more scarce than the attention that an extrovert would have. I'm just wondering if sometimes introverts are more popular or more sought after because of that scarcity factor. And any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, scarcity creates value. Like there's Cialdini, who's probably written the most successful and influential popular books on marketing. So he has a book called Persuasion, and he has a book called Influence. And in his original book, Influence, one of the six principles of persuasion is the scarcity principle, which is that scarcity creates value, right? Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that underpins the whole luxury industry is we value things to the extent that they're unavailable. So if we see social engagement like as a social resource, and we see introverts as people that are inherently more unavailable to us, like holding all else constant, yes, they should be more desirable because they're harder to get access to. So that is true. But then again, that is holding all else constant. And I will say, like, being an introvert, there's a lot packed into that. So they have other things to overcome. But anyway, so I read this book, and a lot of what he talks about inherently is making yourself less available through tools in your Outlook or through tools on your social. Like, how do you make yourself less available to people so that you can use your time, you know, however you want to use it? And I do think, again, we could take a page out of the introvert playbook and all do a bit better of managing that, better job of managing that. Because our time is valuable. And I think it's so interesting to me as somebody who studies scarcity that we understand, like we look at our bank account and we understand what it means when, like, we don't loan our friends money because we understand what it means when we see dollars flying out of our bank account. However, we are more than happy to just give our time willy-nilly to people because that feels like the right thing to do. That feels charitable and giving and kind. At the end of the day, the only way you make money is with your time, right? So we should be applying the same kind of strategic, judicious decision-making to how we give away our time as we do to how we give away our money. By making ourselves less available, oftentimes we will ironically become more desirable. So I think we can all benefit from that and really take a step back and be a little bit more judicious and strategic about the things we say yes to and the speed with which we respond to things. And in doing so, we can kind of maximize our own value for time and be more in control of how we allocate our time as a resource. And also, like you said, you know, we might become more desirable as a resource to other people because there's just less of us to go around.
There you go. All right. So I've alluded to this a few times, and I feel like I've opened a loop that I probably need to close for our listeners. What is a lesson that you learned as a young 20-year-old being on Survivor that now informs how you teach, how your parenting, just informs, what's a lesson that you learned that informs who you are today? Of having had that experience?
That is an interesting question. I want to pick a different one than the one I talked about in the TED Talk. And the TED Talk, what I say a lot is, you know, it was really surprising to me that in the game of Survivor, people are so helpful and nice to each other, which often doesn't make it to the airwaves. But in reality, if you're in a context where you benefit sort of giving to get, like impure altruism, that can powerfully drive your decision-making, right? Like you can see these cultures of people where everybody's being super nice to each other and you assume that it's all driven by this like openness of heart and this kindness and this just kind of altruistic generosity. But oftentimes like we benefit from leveraging our relationships with other people. And I don't know, I would say my takeaway from Survivor and also the research and just my perspective is there's nothing wrong with that. Like I'm sort of on a crusade to rebrand and reclaim the win-win opportunity. Because at least what I see in my research on decision making is like, for example, when you tell people that an eco-friendly product also saves them money, they are less likely to buy it. And to me, that is crazy because you're just highlighting the fact, it should be an additive effect that this product, this eco-friendly product, you're highlighting another, you know, self-relevant benefit that it happens to offer. And the fact that when I tell you it actually benefits you, all of a sudden it turns you off. That's crazy to me. And the reason that I've found in my research that underlies this like aversion to win-win opportunities is at least in the consumer space, oftentimes we don't feel good about helping other people unless we can tell ourselves that we're quote unquote doing it for the right reason. Like we're doing it because we're just purely altruistically like in it for the good of helping others. And I think that's holding us back. I think if we live in a society where helping ourselves by helping others is dirty or shameful, we're less likely to help others, right? And we're also less likely to help ourselves. This is terrible. So I'm on a crusade to say, I think it's perfectly okay to be in social relationships or in professional relationships where, you know, you get something out of it too. But we don't just have to give away our time to help others when it's inconvenient for us. Like we need to consciously think about our own needs and our own goals because we only get so many years on this planet and there's nothing wrong with making the most of them.
That is really interesting, Kelly. Really interesting that we take it away from ourselves. So where can people find you?
I have profgoldsmith.com and all the socials is at profgoldsmith, so P-R-O-F Goldsmith. And watch my TED Talk, please, if you haven't. It's really great.
We will include it in the show notes. Okay, so any final thoughts?
I think as you go through life, we've got a lot of distractions. We've got a lot of phone pings happening constantly. And it's really, really easy to lose sight or marginalize or table your own personal goals, be they scarcity related or not. So for that reason, hold yourself accountable and continually remind yourself of what's important to you and what you want to achieve. Because at the end of the day, you know, your scorecard is going to be whether or not you achieve those things that are most important to you. And I think they're really easy to lose sight of. So I just want to help people kind of keep those top of mind.
Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So much to unpack here, especially as we've been dealing with the constraint of physical distancing and the feelings that have come as a result of this constraint. First, in a time when things feel scarce, resources, social interaction, etc., I found it helpful to hear the results of Kelly's research, that the scarcity itself, that's not the issue, but the absence of hope. If we know that something is truly gone, the boyfriend isn't coming back, the money is lost, things will be different in the future, we can mourn and process that loss, and then lean into the constraint that has been created and grow in a different direction. Ironically, it's when we're clinging to hope that we feel the scarcity and those feelings, they become problematic. So many implications of her research, but as a business leader working with people, it's important not to give hope when there isn't any. Think about how often people say, "I wish they would just tell me what's going on. I wish they would just tell me what's happening." If you know, then you can move on. If you don't know, you start to compensate to protect that hope and fear of scarcity in ways that might not be productive. The kind thing to do from a research perspective is that if there is hope, let people feel hope. If there isn't, don't inadvertently create the scarcity. It's not kind. I was also struck by some of our conversation near the end that we feel if we help someone else, it can't also be helpful to us. That we avoid situations where we're doing something good that also benefits us. This is the opposite problem of only wanting to help ourselves and not others. We do this binary thing as humans, whether it's either or versus both and. But with our higher thinking skills, if we take a step back, we can see that both and is possible and often the best option. Which reminds me of something Stu Friedman said in his podcast episode about how he interacts with his kids. He'll ask them and his wife to tell him, "Where do you think I should be spending my time? And how will that be helpful to you? Both and." It's the love your neighbor and yourself. If you're looking for more guidance around how to grow through disruption, embracing your constraints, leaning into your distinctive strengths, sign up for our weekly email that goes out to tens of thousands of readers across the globe. You can visit whitneyjohnson.com/newsletter to sign up and access our archive of previously sent newsletters. Thank you again to Kelly Goldsmith for being our guest. Thank you to sound engineer Whitney Jobe, managers Melissa Ruddy and Sarah Duran, editor Macy Robison, content contributor Nancy Wilson, and art director, Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself. Disrupt.